Okay.
Hi, Andrew. We're good to go.
Awesome. I can go ahead and turn off my camera.
Cool. All right. So let's start with your year of graduation, including if you finished up spring, summer, fall, and your major or majors.
Okay. I finished up on my coursework in spring of 2020, and I actually got my degree in 2022, and my major was music therapy.
Awesome. And what was your principal instrument?
My principal instrument was cello.
Oh, one of the less common ones.
Yes.
Cool. We will get to your history later.
Okay.
But for now, tell us about your current job. Where do you work? What do you do?
I currently work at Children's Hospital Colorado, and I work as a clinical research coordinator in the Neuroscience Institute. So I support the neurology portfolio of the research institute, and specifically help coordinate projects in dev peds, rehab, and migraine research.
Sorry, dev peds? That sounds like an acronym or something.
Dev peds is developmental pediatrics.
Got it. This hospital, Colorado Hospital, you said?
Yeah, so it's Children's Hospital,
Colorado. Is that what we call a teaching hospital?
I don't know if they consider themselves a teaching hospital, but they, but the main campus that I do work on is on a medical school campus. It's on what's called the Anschutz Medical Campus, which is part of the University of Colorado, Denver.
Okay, interesting. And you said, because you said the neuroscience institutes, this sounds like something other than a neuroscience ward.
Right. Yes, so the so it's research. So it's an institute means that it's just like we are a giant team of researchers and we handle a large portfolio both in neuroscience and outside of neuroscience. So it's like a child, I believe they called it a child health research enterprise, and then they changed the name again recently. But yes, Neuroscience Institute is really just my team of researchers. And then I do outpatient research. Right. So
outpatient, of course, meaning people who don't, who live at home and then come in. For...
Yes, exactly. So I just see research participants who are also patients at Children's. So like they have their neurologist at Children's, or they have their primary care provider there, or they had surgery there or something like that.
About how big is the Neuroscience Institute in terms of like how many people work there?
Yeah, so my team has 12 people in this specific chapter of neurology, and then the whole institute has, I want to say, about 250.
Oh, that's big. That sounds big enough that this might be where people travel from other parts of the country to go there. Would that be accurate?
We do have a really large portfolio of research. We have about 300 active studies right now across a bunch of different disciplines. I have a couple of studies that are completely telehealth, and I do see people from across the state. So all across Colorado. And then I also, work with other children's hospitals on my team, in partnership with these studies. So like one of my studies is in partnership with Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And then I have another one that's in partnership with Boston Children's, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the Mind Institute at UC Davis in California.
Okay. So, I don't want to ask you to give away any trade secrets or whatever, but like, what's the sort of research that you're doing? Like,
That's a great question. So I am primarily doing developmental pediatrics research and migraine research. So I'm on two, well, technically three headache studies. One of them is a phase 3 clinical trial, which is looking at a monthly injectable migraine treatment for patients with chronic migraine.
Is this children specifically?
Yes. So it's already FDA approved for adults. So this clinical trial is looking at efficacy in children.
Gotcha.
And then I have another study. This is the one with Cincinnati that is looking at kind of mind-body techniques, so like non-pharmaceutical intervention for chronic migraine. And it is more of an observational study where we teach an intervention, so like guided imagery or breathing or what have you. I'm blinded to the intervention, so I don't actually know what's happening, and I don't know what they're taught, and I'm not allowed to. But they keep a headache diary every day and mark whether or not they practice those skills. And then we have a bunch of surveys and questionnaires and visits with them to determine whether or not it helped or not. And then I have a couple of developmental pediatric studies where I am, or one study I just actually got off of a grant call for, but it's a vocational counseling study for individuals with developmental and intellectual disability. And it is looking at the point in their childhood where they transition to adulthood, and there's like a cliff of services where they no longer receive those pediatric services, typically at around age 22. And so this study is looking at health outcomes if we pair up these individuals who are transitioning into adulthood with a job. So we're looking at their well-being and their like their vitals and their health, their ED visits, their psychological and mental health well-being, and providing monthly case management and benefits to help them navigate the waivers that they have access to, the state resources that they have, and making sure that they have a job that they are able to maintain and that they can thrive in. So
awesome. I don't think I caught, what's your exact job title?
Yeah, so my exact job title is clinical research coordinator.
Okay. And so you talk about how you work on these studies.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is it that you're doing, right? Like,
yeah.
Are you the one who just type at the data? Are you actually in the room with the child? You know, mm-hmm. Because I imagine there's different people doing different roles in a given study.
Yes, absolutely. So as a coordinator, I'm in what's called an operations role, which essentially just means that I kind of have a split of patient-facing things. So like I will run visits, I schedule things with families, I will walk them through the protocol, I'll make sure that they meet criteria to participate in the study, I route any adverse events or anything that goes wrong in the study to our principal investigator to make sure that we have a physician who has eyes on it. And then on the back end of my role, I do data entry and data management, and I'll coordinate meetings and logistics with different sites if it's a multi-site study, so like with Cincinnati or with Boston or what have you. And that's pretty much what I do. The clinical word in clinical research coordinator essentially just means that I am doing patient-facing human research. So I'm not working with like petri dishes or mice or anything like that.
Okay, but well, when you say you do patient-facing, you talked mm-hmm. about this coordinating role. Are you also, I guess you're patient-facing where you said you interview people to make sure they're fit for a study.
Yeah, so I run their visits. I schedule them, I screen them, and then I meet with them for their visits. And okay. So if there are providers that need to run tests or if there are nurses who need to teach something for the study, I will coordinate all of that with the families to make sure that the providers are available for when we meet. But I take them through different assessments, different surveys, different interviews. I ask them all the questions and then I hand them off to a physician or provider if they're doing something specific. Like I have one one study that requires an endocrinology exam. And obviously I can't do that because I'm not an endocrinologist. So we schedule one and then hand them off to them.
All right. But it sounds like you're sort of the point person that I'm sure you get a lot of questions from the families.
Yes. And I'm also, I am the person who usually has the contact information on like the recruitment flyer and everything. So I'm usually the first point of contact if a family has a question.
Could I ask you just a little bit about the families? Like,
yeah.
What's bringing them in to be research subjects? Is it that they're offered to be paid? Is it that, you know, nothing else worked, so they'll take their chance on this experimental treatment, right? You like, what's the motive of the people you're working with?
Yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag. I think most patient families that I'm seeing for these specific projects are either looking for, they want to participate because there's a gap in their care and this study helps solve it, at least temporarily. Or with the headache studies, typically it's families who have tried all of these different treatments, pharmaceutical or otherwise, and they can't find anything that works consistently for their child's migraines. So they opt into studies or their neurologist refers them to a study.
Gotcha.
So
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. We typically get just referrals from physicians through Children's. So we use an electronic medical record called Epic. And physicians who are aware of our studies will typically just message us or copy their chart for us to reach out to those families.
Gotcha. So let's see, by the way, is your job in-person, remote, hybrid?
It is fully hybrid. I'm usually on site at the hospital about 2 to 3 days a week. Can be more, can be less, depending on the week. Since most of my projects involve telehealth visits, I don't have to be at the hospital in clinic as often as some of my colleagues.
Gotcha. That, I assume it's a salaried position as opposed to...
So it is sort of, I'm guaranteed 40 hours a week, but I'm technically hourly, which essentially just means that within the hospital's operations, and through their eyes of payroll, I am eligible for overtime. So it's really just a way for the hospital to ensure that operations researchers are paid for all of the work that they do.
That's
outside
of both worlds.
Yeah. So,
do you often go north of 40?
Not really. We tried. I think our team does a pretty good job of, or at least my supervisor does a pretty good job of trying to make sure that all of our work is delegated in a way that works for everybody. But if something drastic happens, like there were some major findings for a study that I inherited recently, and I've been having to put in extra hours to clean that up, I've gone overtime for the last two pay periods, but that's very abnormal. And that's actually the first time that's happened since I started this role.
Okay, well, it's good to have the work-life balance, but it's also good that on the occasion that you have to really step up, you get paid for it.
Yes, yeah.
I remember back when I was part-time at Berkeley, there was one time when, like, their other statistics professor left, you know, a couple weeks before the semester started, and mm-hmm. they asked me to cover another class, and I did, and I got paid for it, so...
It's always nice to actually be paid for the work that you're doing.
Yep. Awesome. So, hey, could you take us like hour by hour through what a typical day might look like?
Sure. Yeah. So I have some studies where I will be going to an actual clinic to recruit and screen patients. So like for that developmental pediatrics study, where we're pairing them up with employment counseling and benefits. That is typically from 8 a.m. to noon, just straight through in an actual provider visit at the Children's Hospital. where we will go in after social work, psychology, and physicians, and ask if they're interested in this research. If they are, then we'll go ahead and do what's called an informed consent, and then administer some assessments, and that typically takes about an hour. And then from there, there's a lot of admin work. So I think if I were to kind of boil it down to a typical day, I typically have the first 2 hours of my day to do like responding to emails or prepping for the day if I have a research visit. And then if I'm on site doing something, I'll travel to the hospital, gather paperwork, I'll mail out items if I need to. Sending a lot of emails back and forth with families is a pretty big part of the day. And then at the end of the day, any catch-up work or admin that I need to do. I feel like one of the hallmarks of being a coordinator, at least for an organization this big, is juggling a lot of priorities all at once. So I wish I could say that I really section out my day, but unless I have a dedicated clinic visit, it's pretty scattered. Where like I'll do 15 minutes doing this study and then another 30 minutes on another project, and then I'll spend 20 minutes responding to emails, and then I'll go back and forth with meetings, and then I'll have a back-to-back meeting, and it's definitely hectic working in research.
I understand, but then, let's try this then. One of the criteria you had to hit in order to do one of these interviews is that you enjoy what you do.
Yeah.
What is it about being a clinical research coordinator that you enjoy?
I think that the thing that I enjoy most about it is working with patients and families. And when there is a study that is truly benefiting a family and you can see it and you're getting that feedback, even before we do data analysis on anything, it's very gratifying. Just because they're contributing to science, we are working to forward the science, and at the same time, we get to actually see the benefits of the research that we're doing. And then on the other side of that, I think one thing, like one common thing in research, is that people who are drawn to research typically ask a lot of questions. And the more questions you get answered, the more questions you have. And there's, I guess, something exciting about never actually being at the end, where like you find all these things at the end of a study, and then that unfolds more questions of like, okay, how can we address this shortcoming or what happened here? I think I brought a perspective of like, I worked as a music therapist before pivoting into this role. Mm-hmm. And I think actually working with patients and families as a therapist before kind of stepping into this partially patient, partially admin role kind of helped with kind of seeing the value in what I was doing, even if I wasn't with a patient all the time.
Sure. That's great. So, well, speaking of your background, let's take it back now, I'd say to 2020, although if you feel this story is a logical earlier starting point, we could go back further.
Yeah.
And then we'll take it as you're sort of wrapping up your coursework, mm-hmm. and we'll take it one step at a time from there to where you are now, both in terms of what you're doing for a career, but also like in terms of where you were at mentally regarding your career.
Okay. So starting...
I said we'll start in 2020, although I said if you feel like there was some pivotal event in 2018 or whatever, we can start that.
I mean, I guess with my specific job now, there were a couple of things in 2018 and 2019 that were relevant just because I sought out research internships on my own while I was at Berkeley.
Okay.
So on top of my coursework, I was also a research intern at Boston Children's, and I worked in their cognitive neuroscience labs on a longitudinal dyslexia study.
Oh, wow.
One of their postdocs to do literature reviews for music education and language acquisition for dyslexic.
Research had been a real topic of interest to you.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I had a professor, I think she's still there, Erica Knowles. She teaches the psychology courses. But she kind of helped foster that interest. And she actually wrote me recommendation for this job, and for many other roles that I've had over the years. And I'm like, I am so forever grateful to Erica for everything that she did while I was at Berkeley. 'Cause I wouldn't be where I am today without her guidance and her support. I worked as, a research kind of coordinator, intern, student, on one of her projects at Berkeley as well, where we were doing auditory perception research. It was like an implicit learning study between classically trained and jazz trained musicians on how quickly they could pick up implicit musical patterns.
I remember her talking about that one.
Yeah. So I worked on that.
So, okay, so you said you were interested in research, you had this kind of, you'd helped Erica, Professor Erica Knowles, you'd worked, got this internship at Children's Hospital in Boston. Cool.
Yeah.
We'll take it to where Berkeley's wrapping up then. So.
Yeah, so when 2020 kind of came around, it was my last semester, and I was sort of gearing up for my music therapy internship, and then obviously COVID happened and the world kind of shut down and healthcare was kind of in limbo for a while. A lot of health systems didn't really know how to support interns through a pandemic, which I think is reasonable. So I ended up moving home in 2020. To San Diego. I moved back in with my parents and worked two part-time retail jobs until I got an internship at Tier Memorial Hermann in Houston, Texas.
Is that a hospital?
Yeah, so Tier is T-I-R-R, and then Memorial Hermann is the hospital system. So they are one of the nation's leading neurorehabilitation hospitals. So they see patients for traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury.
How did you get that internship? Did you just apply?
I did apply. Yes. There's an application process for music therapy internships where you submit a written application, and then you also have to do an interview and submit an audition tape for music proficiency for music intervention.
Gotcha. Okay, so, right, so this is a music therapy internship, and I think you mentioned earlier, you're still not officially a Berkeley grad. You probably have to do that internship.
Yeah, so that internship in Houston is, that was my last 6 credits for Berkeley before my degree was actually conferred.
And this was like late 2021 into 2022?
This was January of 2022 to July of 2022.
Gotcha. All right. So you do your internship, you get your degree officially, then now what?
So in my last month or so of that internship, I was looking for work just because it felt a little bit like a cliff drop off after internship. Like, now what? And I was just looking at prospective jobs in different cities and thinking about where I would like to live. And I knew that I wanted to work in neuro rehab for music therapy, which is why I sought out the internship at Tier. And I also did one of my practicums in music therapy at Spalding in Boston, which is also a neuro rehab hospital. And I ended up kind of stumbling upon a job posting for Craig Hospital in Denver, and they are also a specialty hospital in neuro rehab, and they had opened up a it's called PRN, which is as needed work. So it's healthcare part-time, where you're essentially on call.
Okay.
Not a great place to be. I don't recommend it.
Not a great place to work, you mean, or to be a patient?
So Craig was fine. The PRN model of work is not great for healthcare. Unless you have the flexibility of not having any guaranteed income.
Right.
It's rough. I really enjoyed working at Craig for about a year, and I also worked PRN at an inpatient psychiatric hospital in Aurora. That lasted about 4 months, and I realized this really wasn't for me. So I ended
my... That was still music therapy, right? Or
did I... Yes, these were both music therapy jobs. I was trying to figure out how to support myself professionally in the degree that I got from Berkeley. And then things kind of went south at Craig. There were some kind of unfortunate situations between supervision and leadership. And yeah, I don't want to speak ill of Craig. To be a patient there is great because they have so many programs, but to be a therapist there, the burnout rate is so, so high. Pretty much everybody that I worked with there in the past is looking at other careers because it was so intense and just like not a very supportive environment.
Gotcha. So you're telling, you're like, I need to get out of here. I need to.
Essentially, yeah. It was one of those things where, like, I loved what I was doing and realized that if I stayed there, I would be burnt out of my career in probably about 10 years. So I ended up taking a full-time position at an outpatient pediatrics clinic south of the Denver metro area.
Is this music therapy again or not?
Yes, so this is also music therapy. It was my first like full-time music therapy position, and that is when it truly hit me that music therapy pays so poorly in a salaried role. It was, I could not make ends meet with the role.
I won't ask an exact number, but I'm sort of guessing you would not have qualified for this study then?
No, I wouldn't have.
Understood.
Yeah, by kind of a long shot, which is really sad.
Okay, yeah, so it's a full-time job doing what you set to do, but wow, with the pay, and that can make a big difference.
Yes, and I liked the families that I was working with, but they gave me a huge caseload. I had about 18 kids that I was seeing regularly. And it was a travel position, so I had about 9 of those 18 in office, and then the rest of them I had to drive to their homes. And they lived all over the Denver metro area. So I would be in northern Denver and eastern Denver and into the prairies and then down into Castle Rock, which is like, at the time where I was living, was an hour drive one way. And I wasn't reimbursed for any gas mileage because I was a W-2 employee, and I was just losing money working at this place. I loved the team that I was working with. My supervisor was super supportive. It was cool to work with an actual music therapy team. Like I had colleagues who were music therapists, which was new. But I couldn't make it work, and I started looking for other positions, both in and out of music therapy.
How long were you there until you started looking for other positions?
I gave it about 6 months before I started looking because I wanted to like settle in, and I was like, maybe I'm just overreacting. I was not overreacting. It was simply not sustainable. And then I started sending out applications for music therapy jobs, non-music therapy jobs. I wanted to get back into research somehow, and I didn't really know how. I ended up applying for an audiology assistant position at Children's, and they passed my resume to the Research Institute. So I got a call from a hiring manager at Children's for this role, and I didn't even apply for it.
That's awesome.
And they asked if I was interested in coming in for an interview, and I said, absolutely. And it was a really smooth and supported transition. I was able to give my employer a month's notice so that I was able to truly do terminations with all of my clients at their clinic. And sure that there was an actual warm handoff between providers so that people could pick them up and they didn't have a gap in their care, which doesn't happen that often. And I've been in this role ever since, and it's been a year now. A year now.
Fantastic. Yeah, so just before you mess up, how long did it take you to find a job once you started applying?
Like, how long did it take for me
you
to find
the previous job you were at? You said you went, you were there for about 6 months before you started applying to positions elsewhere.
Yeah.
How long were you there total?
I was in that position for, oh boy, let's see. I don't even remember when I started. I was there for 8 months.
Oh, so fairly quickly you got in another position.
Yes.
That's great.
Which is, I feel very grateful that it didn't take that long, because I have friends who have struggled with trying to find positions outside of their industry that they're currently in.
Sure. Sure, got it. All right, cool. So, and as you said, you were hired into your current role.
Yes, yeah.
All right, great. Well, let's move on to the third part of the interview of three. And I'm going to preface the next question with, there is no right or wrong answer.
Okay.
So these days, let's define these days as, you know, spring, summer of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
What, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
I find myself missing music therapy quite a bit. I definitely don't want to let go of my license, and I don't want to let go of the profession. I went to Berkeley knowing that I wanted to do music therapy, and I stuck with that, and I never changed my major. It's like I had tunnel vision through all of my undergrad, and I don't regret any of that, because I do think that it was the right profession for me. It was really just the financial support, and Colorado hasn't really caught up. I think outside of missing working in music a little bit, I don't play instruments as much as I used to. Like, I have kind of a music room set up, but I don't really use it. And I don't really play my cello very much, because I don't feel like I have that much of a reason to, unless I join like a community orchestra or something like that. One of the things I really enjoyed at Berkeley that I did with cello was film scoring sessions. But Colorado is not really a great place for film scoring. So those would all kind of be remote gigs, and I don't feel like I have the energy to, or the bandwidth to make those connections at this point in my career.
No problem. So there's no right or wrong answer.
Yeah. But I think I listen to music, and I am constantly seeking out new music, and I'm still very close with a lot of people that I went to college with. And I try to support them as much as I can. I'm still very much a fan of live music. I don't think music is ever going to be something that exits my life completely. And I hope to return to some capacity to music therapy in the future. I just don't really know what that looks like at this point in time.
I understand. By the way, I think I missed it. Sorry if I missed it. Why Colorado? What did you just sort of go there for a job and you liked it and stayed there?
Yeah, I mean, I relocated for the position at Craig Hospital, which is in Colorado. And out of all the places that I was looking, Denver seemed like the best fit. I am a like outdoor enthusiast, I guess. I've been rock climbing for about 9 years, and Colorado is a perfect place for rock climbing. So it was a really easy way for me to meet people, and I joined a gym and I climb outdoors, and I also grew up skiing, so Denver is a great place to be in to have easy access to snow sports. I also love hiking and camping and backpacking, and so.
You know, it's funny, all the people I've interviewed, I feel like Denver is the only city where a majority of people I've interviewed, you're not even in this group, but a majority of the people I interviewed who are in that city kind of went, I really want to live in Denver. All right, I'll move and see what I can get.
Yeah, I felt like it was a sign when I got the job at Craig that I was like, okay, I guess I'm moving to Colorado.
Awesome.
And I have no desire to leave. I feel like of all the cities that I've lived in, Boston, San Diego, and Houston, Denver's been the best fit by far.
Cool. So next question I have for you is, okay, thinking of your current role as a clinical research coordinator, mm-hmm. I mean, music therapy was a logical path into that career. But
yes.
There are plenty of other logical paths into that career as well.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and Berkeley gives that bachelor of music degree, and you went there knowing that, and you're doing some cool stuff. But all that, so, but beyond the fact that it's a bachelor's degree and, you know, maybe your subject matter did feed you into this type of career in a way that some others would, but some others would not.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you feel your Berkeley experience did particularly well to prepare you for what you're doing now?
Oh. I think one thing that I realized was unique about Berkeley when I was attending and kind of comparing my college experience to my peers who are at other schools was just the sheer volume of classes that we were taking. Like I was taking between 8 and 12 classes a semester at Berkeley, and that was just considered normal. And I think that helped me with kind of this priority juggling that I'm now doing in my professional role. I think networking has always been a huge part of the Berkeley experience. And I think that set me up for the professional world a little bit better, than maybe like in another university would, where I would be in this like insular kind of major where I'm only with those peers. And then obviously Dr. Erica Knowles, I took all of her classes. after I took general psych, I signed up for, I took biopsych with her, and that's kind of what propelled me into where I am now. Cause I always had this like fascination, with the neuroscience of music, which is what drove me to music therapy. And she helped me explore ways to answer those questions, and meet people in different institutions outside of Berkeley to help explore what is possible, both in and outside of music therapy.
Great answers. So if you have something else to add, go for it. Otherwise, we'll flip that question around.
Okay.
Because Berkeley gives that one degree, the Bachelor's of Music, and as noted, you got it. You're doing something sort of adjacent to what that was about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're doing very well for yourself. But all that said, is there anything where you look back at your Berkeley education, you say, you know, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything mm-hmm. missing or incomplete?
That is a great question. I think that some of the later courses, like the professional development seminars, tried to set us up. There's one conversation that I remember having with the chair of the music therapy department. And I was looking at internships and trying to complete my degree. And I was telling them, like, I can't afford this. It is a 6-month unpaid full-time job, and this is not realistic. And I went in asking for resources and advice, and if there were loans that I could go for, or scholarships or grants or whatever. And the only thing that they said was, have your parents pay for it. And that was really disappointing. And I did find at Berkeley that there was a lot of permeating financial privilege, where music therapy specifically was trying to become more accessible. And at the end of the day, it just became this unattainable profession, unless you had a safety net to fall back on. And I think the internship was just the beginning of that, where, like, the only way I could even finish my degree at Berkeley was by moving back in with my parents and working 2 jobs to save up enough to afford the rest of my degree. So.
Gotcha. That's interesting. That's very real.
Yeah. Right. I know
any other major, you'd have been done.
Sorry?
I just said if you had majored in anything else at Berkeley, you'd have been done and it would have been a non-issue.
Yes. Yeah. It's just like, it felt like a unique and awful situation to be in, where, like, I wasn't going to get my degree if I didn't figure out a way to do this, even after completing all of the classes that I was required. I know that I think something that kind of struck me at Berkeley was how a lot of students tended to be in their own world, in like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to succeed and anything else is not really an option. And I respect that drive, but I also think that having more resources at Berkeley to kind of prepare for the quote unquote real world, like any kind of like financial literacy classes or like something like that. I know that like that's not, I don't know how realistic that is for a music school. But there is a business side of everything that not just music business majors would have benefited from.
Sure. Sure. Cool. Great answer. So next question I have for you is, again, you did music therapy for a bit, where the job that was really not fun, and mainly because of financial end, and then you got out and you're in a very good position. Not everyone has found that good position. You've graduated mm-hmm. recently, and also you have all those people, at Berkeley staring out into the big scary world and not sure what comes next.
Yeah.
So for either or both of those groups, what advice do you have?
Oh. I think I would say that the skills that you have and that you've learned at Berklee are useful in more than just music, because you're learning very real world skills by collaborating with your peers and building up communities. And really all you're doing in any career that you pursue is finding a community that you enjoy being in. I have some peers who graduated Berklee and they are still doing music, and a side job is really just a way to fund the lifestyle that they really want. And I think that that is a completely valid way of looking at it. If you don't find a career that you are super passionate about that is not music, if music is no longer an option or not feasible at the moment, I don't think there's any shame in trying to find ways to support what does make you happy, because at the end of the day, that's what's going to drive you, instead of driving yourself into a position that you don't want to be in. Because I work with some people like that, and it's miserable, and I don't envy them. So I think Berklee students are already ahead of the game in some aspects, and that they already know that there's something that they're really, really passionate about and that they want to do something with. And I admire that.
Very cool. And now to focus in a little bit. I think I mentioned earlier, you're my 250th interview. No one's listening to all 250. But I feel like you're my second or third type of, you know, medical research person.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who's made this far is almost certainly someone who saw your clinical research coordinator and was like, okay, that could be an interesting career. Let's find out what that's about.
Mm-hmm.
So for someone who's not doing it yet, but they're thinking about this type of job, do you have any specific advice for them?
I will say that it is very difficult to break into research with no prior research experience. So any opportunities that you can seek out to gain that experience, even if it's like a shadowing opportunity or like becoming a research assistant somewhere, is typically the starting point, where you're really just focusing on data entry and then you work up to coordinator, where you are working with people. But I think figuring out what area of research that you're interested in is a good start. So like, what is driving you towards this profession? What are the questions that you're asking yourself that you are curious about? And like, what area of research is going to help you explore that a little bit more? There's a lot of research out there, and a small portion of it is with humans, and a vast majority of it is with cells. So,
gotcha. All right, no, that's a good point. Good way to put a logical entry. And hey, you don't have to get cells to sign a waiver.
Yes, that's true. there is a lot of red tape in human research, so that is definitely something to be aware of. Just learning the ropes of compliance and making sure that you're keeping your research subjects safe, and that research is being conducted ethically, is a lot of the learning curve.
Cool. All right, Andrew, well, I just got one last question for you.
Okay.
You have the mic. Is there anything we missed or anything else you'd like to say?
I don't think so. I really appreciate that you are doing this project. I wish that I had awareness of it while I was an undergrad. I probably would have utilized it. Thank you.
You're very welcome, and thanks for nice words. So I say at least more of the graduates today are finding out about this, and you're part of that now. So, all right, great. Thank you so much again for making the time today, Andrew. It was a really interesting conversation.
Of course.
Yeah, good luck with everything.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care now.
You too. Bye-bye.